going here. In our study here in Genesis, we've been working our way through the development of the various aspects of the Abrahamic covenant. We were actually introduced to that back in chapter 12, but what we've been watching unfold as we've gone forward from there is the establishment of the provisions of that covenant. Now, there's three main provisions of the Abrahamic covenant. You remember what those are? Land, seed, and blessing. Usually they're then in that order and probably can remember them in that way. The land is was kind of defined for us back in Genesis chapter 15. It's where we saw the land. Let's just remind ourselves one more time of what that is. Here's kind of an outline of it, as you can see here. There's a little bit of debate about it, but I think this is probably the best understanding we're going to get is what you see up here. And the reason that those two accounts, one is in Numbers 34 and the other one is Ezekiel 47, the reason they don't overlay perfectly is that some of the boundaries are defined by where people are living, tribes and peoples, and so they move around a little bit. But basically, as you can see there from that pattern, it's roughly what we know Palestine to be today. It goes a little further north than what we've talked about before. And as it's partitioned out during the tribulation period, the different tribes get a stripe like this. They get a horizontal stripe of land across there, all 12 of them, from north down to the south. And in the middle will be an allotment to David or his successor that will be assisting the Lord in the administration of the millennial kingdom. He'll get a stretch right across Jerusalem there that is divided up in a variety of ways. But that's basically the land. That was defined for us earlier. The blessing that will be associated with the Abrahamic covenant is ultimately fulfilled in the person of Christ. But all people of faith are considered sons of Abraham, and they receive the blessings of Abraham as well. So we all, believers, are all essentially benefactors of the blessing, but it culminates in the person of Christ. And then the seed part of this covenant is what we've been seeing primarily here now since the call of Abraham in chapter 12. His seed proceeded from himself, that is, his line of descent proceeded from Abraham down through Isaac, the younger of his sons, and then from him through Jacob, the younger of his sons. But it hadn't been very many people involved there, has it? Just a handful of people. Until Jacob came on the scene, and then he started the actual proliferation of this nation up in Mesopotamia. Remember, Jacob, his four wives produced 12 sons. We'll just go ahead and say 12, 11 up there plus one later, but we'll say 12 sons over a period of about 7 years or so. And that was the formation of the beginning of the seed provision of the Abrahamic covenant. So we've been kind of watching, been seeing nation building going on here in the last few chapters. It began in turmoil. You remember up there in Mesopotamia, we had the baby wars, where the wives were all fighting amongst themselves to try to father sons on with Jacob. And that was kind of a mixed up mess. But nevertheless, the Lord started the nation from that situation up there. And then they came back down to started their home region down here in Hebron after a while, and after certain other events took place. And we're sort of settled down here in this place. So the nation began up north, but came back into what will be the promised land later. And they were living down in this area here. Let's see if my laser is working here this morning. Yeah, they're living down here when we left off last, down around in through here. Now, the narrative has been focused primarily lately on one of Jacob's 12 sons, namely Joseph. Joseph was a favorite son of his because he was a son of Rachel, his favorite wife. So favoritism is just kind of permeating this family. He's favorite wives, he's got favorite sons, and they know when they are in the favored status and when they are not. And so we saw some turmoil arise because of that. Joseph's brothers were envious and jealous of his favoritism, and they turned on him. So much so that a hatred developed between them, and they wanted to kill him. And when we left off last week, his brothers had let him, in essence, be bought as a slave by a caravan of Ishmaelites going down to Egypt. So Joseph is going to move now from that territory where he was. He actually was up in this region up here. Dothan, yeah, he was out up there when he took him captive. And they brought him down now to Egypt. So when we left off last week, verse 36 of chapter 37 says, "Meanwhile, the Midianites sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, Pharaoh's officer, the captain of the bodyguard." So Joseph has gotten separated from the family now, sold into slavery by his brothers, and taken down to Egypt and sold into slavery down there. We'll talk more about why that's happened. But one interesting aspect to Joseph's movement and his being sold into captivity in Egypt is, you think there's any satanic fingerprints on that activity? What happens if some of these boys don't really turn into what God wants them to turn into, and they're taken out of the picture or become captives or things of that sort? So we'll have to kind of watch for that as we go along and see if we could see some satanic intervention in this as well. Okay, so Joseph was the main focus of the narrative till we get to chapter 38, and all of a sudden it changes. About that time, Judah departed from his brothers. Judah's one of the 12. He was one of Leah's sons. Remember, she had six. He's one of her six. So now Judah all of a sudden steps up and becomes a player. It was Judah who intervened on behalf of Joseph to get him sold instead of killed. Remember, Reuben wanted to put him in a hole and come back later and get him out and save him, but he couldn't get that accomplished because the brothers sold him while he was gone. But Judah stepped forward and suggested that they sell him instead of killing him. So he had that role in regards to Joseph. So let's see what this tells us about Judah and what it's got to do here. About that time, Judah departed from his brothers and visited a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. Now, Judah's physical movement here is, again, picturesque of his spiritual movement, I think. He's gone from down here at the family camp, and he's headed up to right in through here. This city's not on this map, but it's about up here, about where that red dot is. So Judah has now moved away from the environment of his family, from God's people, and has kind of snuggled up against this Canaanite guy, this guy called Hira. He's an Adullamite. He's from the city of Adullam, which is about 15 miles northwest of Hebron, where the family was living. So Judah has moved away from the godly people and the godly influences, and he's now getting tight with the godless, the Canaanites, in this particular city called Adullam. And I suspect, again, as I say, his physical movement is kind of indicative of his spiritual movement, and we might ask ourselves, what do you think the chances of there being some problems developing here are when we move away from God and his people deeper and deeper into the world and its people? Remember what they know about the Canaanites. Remember in chapter 24, verse 3, Abraham told his servant Eliezer, "And I'll make you swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and the God of earth, that you shall not take for a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites." Abraham knew that do not intermix with those Canaanites. And in chapter 28, verse 1, Isaac knew that. He called Jacob and blessed him and charged him and said to him, "You shall not take a wife from the daughters of Canaan." So the patriarchs knew to stay away from intermarrying Canaanite women. So what does Judah do? Verse 2, "He saw there the daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua. That's the Canaanite's name. The daughter's name is actually Bathshua. We'll learn that in 1 Chronicles. Bathshua is her name, daughter of Shua. And he took her and went into her, and she conceived and bore him a son, and he named him Ur. So what does Judah do? He's moved away from God's people, and he's married a Canaanite woman. And they have a son. Son number one is named Ur. Then she conceived again and bore a son and named him Onan. And she bore still another son and named him Shelah. And it was at Chezib that she bore him. And it's just a city up there in that general area. So what's Judah done? He's gone off and married him a Canaanite woman. And he's fathered three sons. Abraham wouldn't have been happy. Isaac wouldn't have been happy because they said, stay away. Now, it's not the outward appearance of the Canaanites that's the problem. These are probably attractive women. It's what's inside that's unattractive. And God said, stay away. But he didn't. He went and married this Canaanite woman. So, he's now a married man with three children. And when his son grew up, he took a wife for Ur, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. T-A-M-A-R. So when his first son grows up to some degree of manhood, they married pretty early in those days, so he might not have been more than a teenager, Judah goes out and picks a wife for him. And she was a Canaanite, and her name was Tamar. So Tamar was married to Ur, Judah's firstborn, but Ur was evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord took his life. Yikes. Now, there's a lot of sinners running around on the planet. Why does the Lord get personally involved with this guy and slay this guy? He's not your average, everyday sinner. He is extra, extra evil. There's something about this guy, Ur, that is so wicked and so evil that God steps into the scene and slays him himself. That's rare. Usually God doesn't slay individuals because of their wickedness. We see the city of Sodom and Gomorrah in a few instances that might be an exception to that, but not normally does he do this. Where did this guy learn this kind of evil that brings this kind of judgment from God? Pray tell. And he got a Canaanite mother, doesn't he? I don't think it was from Judah. I don't know that it was from his mother, but who else? Somehow or another, this guy is so bad. This son of a Canaanite woman and Judah, that God slays him. Yeah, that marriage didn't get off to a rip-roaring start, did it? So Judah says to Onan, that's his second son now, go into your brother's wife and perform your duty as a brother-in-law to her and raise up offspring for your brother. Now this is called the Levirate marriage relationship, and what it was all about, and this is before it was incorporated into the Mosaic Law. This was a social custom of the day that later was incorporated into the Mosaic Law. And what it's all about here is if a guy has a brother who is married and the married brother dies, the other brother is supposed to go into his sister-in-law and father a child through her so that the brother that died has an heir. He has a descendant. He has someone that can inherit his property and it continue on. So his name and his property and everything be continued on. So it was a provision to try to keep a family's name and its property proceeding on down through a line of descent. So the living brother, in this case, Onan, is told by Judah, go into Ur's wife, widowed wife, who is Tamar, and father a child through her so she has a child and an heir to continue on. Well, old Onan, he ain't really into that too much. Verse 9, he says, he knew that the offspring would not be his, so it came about that when he went into his brother's wife, he wasted his seed on the ground in order not to give offspring to his brother. Now, Onan realizes that there's two boys left here, himself and the younger son, Shelah. So he now, Onan, is now the older of the two, so he gets the double inheritance that the oldest child always gets. Onan is in line to get two portions of Judah's estate, and his younger brother would get one. So he'd get, if there was two boys, there would be three shares. Onan gets two, Shelah gets one. If there's four boys, the other kid, who was Er's son, he's reckoned the oldest. So he gets the two shares, and the other two get a quarter each. So Onan figures out, hey, this is going to cost him some money. If he fathers a child through Tamar, it will cost him some money in regards to Judah's estate. So he says, I don't think so. So he uses this technique that has become known as Onanism. I'm actually having a term named after him. He doesn't mind going into her, but he is not going to impregnate her. He's trying to enjoy certain aspects of this relationship without fulfilling his duty. And the Lord was not happy with him in verse 10. What he did was displeasing in the sight of the Lord, and he took his life also. Strike two for Judah's boys. Now the second son is slain because he refused to do his duty as a brother-in-law and provide a child through Tamar. So Tamar is now twice widowed because of God's judgment on these boys. So Judah then says to his daughter-in-law, Tamar, remain a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah grows up. For he thought, well, I'm afraid that he too may die like his brothers. So Tamar went and lived in her father's house. Now Judah is less than noble in this particular situation. He sends his daughter-in-law back to her father's house to live, pretending that he's going to give her his third son, Shelah, as soon as he's old enough to marry. So he doesn't even take care of her, his own daughter-in-law. He sends her back to her original father. She has no standing with her father, her original father, because she's left the house. She's been married and gone away. She's twice widowed. So she's got nothing there. And Judah doesn't take care of her. He basically just sweeps her under the rug and throws her out, misleading her or pretending that he's going to give her a husband when his third son grows up enough to marry. So what a deal. You got a twice widowed Canaanite young lady, Tamar, living apart from her proper family, Judah, figuring out over time, I'm sure that, hey, this guy ain't giving me another son. I'm on my own here. I got nothing. I got no recourse. I got no chance for a husband. I got nothing here. And so Judah kind of messes this situation up pretty good, doesn't he? He was told to stay away from the Canaanites, but oh no, they look good. He ain't gonna stay away from them. Two out of his three sons have been slain by God personally because of their wickedness. Now, verse 12, after a considerable time, Shua's daughter, the wife of Judah, died. So now he's single again. He doesn't have a wife anymore. Judah doesn't. And when the time of mourning was ended, I told Pam driving down, I think that was 15 minutes, but I'm not sure. Might have been a little longer. Judah went up to his sheep shears at Timnah, he and his friend Hira the Adullamite, this is a Canaanite bud, they're going to go up to where some sheep shearing was going on. Now, these sheep shearing activities are kind of like festivals. They're kind of like conventions. What happens at conventions? Not all good, huh? Now, in fact, there's a circuit of prostitutes that follow conventions around this country. They go where the convention is. They just move with the conventions around the country, a circuit of them. So here's our bud Judah up there at the sheep shearing convention. And Tamar was told that he was up there. Verse 13, it was told to Tamar, behold, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep. So she knows what the environment is going to be like. So she removed her widow's garments and covered herself with a veil and wrapped herself and sat in the gateway of Enaim, which is on the road to Timnah. For she saw that Shelah had grown up and she had not been given to him as a wife. So what's Tamar going to do? She knows what the score is now. She ain't going to get this third son. Judah ain't about to give him to her. So when this occasion arises for a bit of a promiscuity that is normally anticipated in these kinds of things, she decides she's going to take advantage of it and dress herself up as a prostitute, probably a temple prostitute, and go sit out there where she can possibly encounter Judah, father-in-law, or ex-father-in-law, whatever the case may be here. So she dresses the part and decides to try to take matters into her own hands and gets into it here. And when Judah saw her, he thought she was a harlot, for she covered her face. She's got on the trappings of harlotry, however they dress, and veil on her face or whatnot. So he thinks now that she's just a regular, everyday prostitute. And he turned aside to her by the road and said, here now, let me come into you. Now, he isn't married anymore, so it's not quite as bad as he was betraying his wife. He is single at least now, but he doesn't know that this is his daughter-in-law. He did not know she was his daughter-in-law, and she said, what will you give me that you may come into me? They haggle the price. He said, well, I'll give you a kid from the flock. Prostitutes would take plastic or goats, whichever you happen to have on you. They preferred goats, I think. So he tells her he'll give her a goat, a kid from the flock. Well, he doesn't have one with him, of course. So she says, well, will you give me a pledge until you send it? That is, let me hold something of value of yours until I get that promised payment, and then I'll give you back your items of value or whatever. So he says, that's cool. And he says, I'll give you, or he asked her, he said, what shall I give you as a pledge? And she said, well, your seal and your card and your staff that is in your hand. The seal was usually a cylindrical tube-like thing with a symbol on the bottom of it that you could then stamp into melted wax to seal letters and things of that sort, and that was your signature in effect. And they wore it around their necks with a card usually. So he gives her this signature thingy with the cord and his staff. The staffs were typically personalized carvings so that they identified whoever owned them quite clearly. So she's got his driver's license and his serial number. She can identify this guy really clearly, no doubt whatsoever on those parts. His seal, his card, and his walking stick. So he gave him to her and went into her, and she conceived by him. Now what's the chances? A one-time encounter and she's pregnant? Remember, we've talked about this before, Emma. Who controls the womb? God controls the womb, doesn't he? He can close it, he can open it. He can make it fertile, as in this case, or he can close it and she cannot bear. But in this case, she is pregnant after a one-time encounter. So she arose and departed and removed her veil and put on her widow's garments. So she goes back into the widow's mode after this encounter with her father-in-law. So when Judah sent the kid to by his friend the Adullamite to receive the pledge from the woman's hand, he couldn't find her. So he sends his bud with the goat and says, go give her the goat and get my stuff back. Get my driver's license and social security number back from this woman. But she's not there. So he asks around, saying, well, where's the temple prostitute who was by the road at Enam? And he said, hey, there's not been a temple prostitute here. So, and strangely enough, the guys know, huh? They know, hey, ain't been no prostitute here. They keep tabs of that kind of stuff, I guess. So she's not there and can't be found. So he returned to Judah and he said, well, I didn't find her. And furthermore, the men of the place said, there has been no temple prostitute here. So best laid plans didn't work out. So he says, oh, well, just let her have them. Let her keep them, lest we become a laughing stock. After all, I sent the kid, and you did not find her. Hey, I tried to pay the debt, okay? It's not my fault she wasn't there. Not my problem, okay? Let's don't pursue this any further. People will be laughing their heads off at us if they find out we hired a prostitute and she wasn't even there, and so on and so forth. So, end of story as far as Judah is concerned. But it's not the end of the story. It was about 3 months later that Judah was informed, your daughter-in-law Tamar has played the harlot, and behold, she is also with child by harlotry. Well, about 3 months go by, and she can't button them Calvin Kleins anymore. And it becomes obvious that she has been sexually promiscuous, his daughter-in-law, Judah's daughter-in-law. She's pregnant. Judah, what are you going to do about that? Well, he's been, I think, inclined to want to get rid of her any way he could all along, since his second son bit the big one. So he just says, hey, I know what to do. Bring her out here and let her be burned. Let's put her to death. Prostitution, punishable by death. So let's get rid of her. So a golden opportunity, he thinks, has befallen him. So while she was being brought out, that she sent to her father-in-law saying, I am with child by the man to whom these things belong. She said, examine to see whose signet ring and cords and staff are these. So she says, hey, the guy who impregnated me was the owner of these things. She still got them, of course. That signet ring, the stamp, and the cord, and the walking stick. And so she sticks those in Judas's face. And in verse 26, he recognized him and said, she's more righteous than I, inasmuch as I did not give her my son Shelah, and he did not have relations with her again. Now, for all of the unappealing characteristics we see in Judah up to this point in time, he at least is man enough about it to admit he is the one that is the greatest proponent of error here. He recognizes that he lied to her about his third son, and that he is really the one who is at fault. And to his credit, there was nothing incestuous about this. It was promiscuous, to be sure, but not incestuous. He did not touch her again and have any kind of a relationship with her again. So there is now a line of descent from Judah through this young lady, Tamar. It's Judah's line of descent, not the Canaanite woman's son, Ur or Onan, Odin the Barbarian, I guess we could call it. It's Judah's son that is now, well, our sons, as the case may be here, that is in the line of descent. So, came about at the time that she was giving birth that, behold, there were twins in her womb. Two sons are brought into the world as a result of this relationship between Judah and Tamar. Moreover, it took place while she was giving birth that one put out a hand, and the midwife took and tied a scarlet thread on his hand, saying, this one came out first. But it came about as he drew back his hand, should never draw it back, I guess, that behold, his brother came out. Then she said, well, what a breach you have made for yourself. So he was called Perez. Perez is the second one out. He's the younger. The first guy got his hand out, but he drew it back in, and the second child, the younger of the two, actually came out first, Perez. So of these two children, we see the same sort of thing that happened with Esau and Jacob. The younger, in this case, came out first. Afterward, his brother came out, who had a scarlet thread on his hand, and he was named Zerah. So between these two boys now, Perez is the one that actually is in the line of descent for Messiah. From Perez came David, and from David comes Messiah. So these two sons, and one in particular, Perez, now, continues on the line of descent from Judah down to Messiah. Remember, he's the lion from the tribe of Judah? So Perez is the son that propagates that line. So here we have a Canaanite woman, Tamar, who is the mother of, ultimately, through descent, the Messiah. So, as unappealing as various aspects of this whole encounter are, once again, we see, as some of you have already noted in here, how God is able to take and make something out of nothing. He can take the messes that we make, and he can turn them into something good. God can do a work through his wayward children, and does all the time. There's a couple of scripture passages we ought to remind ourselves of. Philippians 2:13, for it is God who is at work in you, both to will and to do his good pleasure. It is a fact of scripture that we are all works in process, aren't we? And God can use us in spite of our own miserable failures, and does, if we're willing to be used. And he does that in this particular case with Judah. Judah should have never gone there in the first place. He should have never hooked up with a Canaanite wife. He should have done what was proper in regards to his daughter-in-law, Tamar. He should not have gotten involved with a prostitute. All of that stuff are instances of bad judgment and mistakes on the part of Judah, and yet God nevertheless used this situation to produce a line of descent from whom Messiah would come. So Philippians 2:13 works, Romans 8:28. We know that all things, that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love God and those who are called according to his purpose. So he can take these mistakes and mold them into something beneficial to us, and does from time to time. So a good lesson to remind ourselves of from time to time, that it's not a license to just commit sin willy-nilly, but nevertheless God can use us and does from time to time. So that was Judah's experience, and his behavior and actions sort of stand in marked contrast to what we're going to see here in Joseph as we go along. The morality being worked out in the life of Judah and his Canaanite associates is not what we see in the life of Joseph down there in Egypt. So let's look at that. Let's look at chapter 39, see what's going on with him. Back to Joseph now in the narrative. Now, Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an Egyptian officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the bodyguard, bought him from the Ishmaelites and had taken him down there. In verse 2, the Lord was with Joseph, So he became a successful man. He was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. And we'll see that expression, the Lord was with Joseph, repeated three times in this chapter. It is clear that God's blessing, God's shepherding of Joseph's life is very much a reality here. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. It reminds me of Psalm 23, where all the benefits of having the Lord shepherding our lives are there, and we'll see them here in Joseph's life. His master saw that the Lord was with him and how the Lord caused all that he did to prosper in his hand. So Joseph found favor in his sight and he became his personal servant. He made him overseer over his house, and all that he owned he put in his charge. And came about that from the time he made him overseer in his house and over all that he owned, that the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house on account of Joseph. Thus the Lord's blessing was upon all that he owned in the house and in the field. So he left everything he owned in Joseph's charge, and with him there he did not concern himself with anything except the food which he ate. And Joseph was a hunk, handsome in form and appearance. The principle we see here in Joseph's life is the one that I think is probably keeping our country together to the extent that it is today, and that is that God will bless at times the ungodly for the sake of the godly. Potiphar is doing really well here in life because of Joseph. Our country is avoiding God's judgment, I think, at this point in time because of the church. The church is here. Believers are here. And so I think if we weren't, as we will be gone immediately after the rapture, God's judgment will really start to befall this place. So the country is benefiting from the fact that the church is here, just like Potiphar did here. Okay, it came about after these events, verse 7, that his master's wife looked with desire at Joseph, and she said, "Lie with me." Doesn't beat around the bush or anything, gets right to the point, doesn't she? Now, something is bad wrong here in Potiphar's household. Potiphar is the captain of the bodyguard of Pharaoh. He's probably not some broken down, used up old squirrel like me. He's probably a younger, relatively young, energetic man to be in that position. His wife is probably an attractive trophy wife type. And yet she is very sexually unfulfilled because she tries to take advantage of Joseph and tries to seduce him. Why isn't Potiphar taking care of things at home? He's probably not there enough. He's probably too busy socially climbing and trying to get somewhere in his work that he's neglecting his wife. Scriptures teach us that the wife's body belongs to the husband's body belongs to the wife, and they're to both work at satisfying each other's needs. Clearly, that ain't happening in this household. So she tries to pounce on poor Joseph. He's just a young man, 17, 18 years old. And verse 8, he refused. I'm impressed that a man this age who's living on hormones instead of any other form of thought process and so on, refuses this attempt at seduction by Potiphar's wife, who I suspect is probably a very attractive woman. And sexually frustrated and hungry because Potiphar is not perhaps taking care of business. He refuses. And instead of three words, he gives her a little more explanation here. He says, "Hey, behold with me here, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house, and he's put all that he owns in my charge. There's no one greater in his house than I, and he has withheld nothing from me except you, because you're his wife. How then could I do this great evil and sin against God?" So he says, look, the guy trusts me. And God doesn't want this sort of behavior on the part of his children. So he gives her the explanations, reasons why. He doesn't just simply say, well, I don't want to touch you because you just ain't appealing to me or anything like that, which would make her even worse, make her even madder. He tries to explain logically why he doesn't want to get involved with her. Impressive for a young man, isn't it? I wouldn't have thought so. Reminds me a little bit of Daniel. He's so impressive. So she tries to use the drip method. She just kind of works on him a little bit each day. Came about as she spoke to Joseph day after day that he did not listen to her, to lie beside her or be with her. Now that can't be easy, to be getting an invitation of that sort every day, day in and day out. But Joseph, he withholds. He stands tall here. So it happened though on one day, verse 11, he went into the house to do his work, that none of the men of the household was there inside. Now that's a bad situation to begin with, isn't it? Just him and her in there alone. And she caught him by his garment, saying, lie with me. A couple of things kind of feature prominently in Joseph's life, don't they? Goats and garments. That garment he had on before about got him killed. And they used that to deceive his father. Now she grabs him by the lapels of his coat and says, lie with me. And all he could do is peel out of that thing and get out of there. He left his garment in her hand and fled and went outside. Now, unfortunately, in having to flee in that way, he leaves something behind that can be used against him, doesn't he? There's a piece of evidence there that she can use. And she does. When she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and had fled outside, she called to the men of her household and said to them, see, he brought this Hebrew into us to make sport of us. Kind of tries to associate them with the offense, these other men in the house, and kind of get their participation in supporting her here. He's making sport of us. Well, I don't think he did anything to them. It's just to her. It's just what she's bummed out about. He came in to lie with me, and I screamed. And this is where the expression, liar, liar, pants on fire, came from. Lying through her teeth about the whole thing. So it came about when he heard that I raised my voice and screamed that he left his garment beside me and fled and went outside. So she left his garment beside her until his master came home, Potiphar. Then she spoke to him with these words, the Hebrew slave whom you brought to us came in to me to make a sport of me. Doesn't sound like she was all in favor of bringing Joseph into the family there to begin with, does she? And so she says to her husband that he took advantage of me. And it happened as I raised my voice and screamed that he left his garment beside me and fled outside. And here it is, I got the garment. I got the proof positive of my story right here in my hand. So it came about when her master heard the words of his wife, which she spoke to him, saying, this is what your slave did to me, that his anger burned. Potiphar is chapped. But at whom? He's mad, but you got to wonder how much old Potiphar really understands here, because Joseph's master took him and put him in the jail, the place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in the jail. Now, Potiphar could have had him executed. Why does he not? Maybe he knows Mrs. Potiphar a little better than she thinks. Maybe he suspects that her story is not quite as precisely accurate as it could be. I suspect he did, but he has to do something. He can't just dismiss the whole deal. So he puts him in jail where the king's prisoners were confined. So now Joseph has been moved from one place in captivity there over to another place in captivity where he's now rubbing elbows with guys that the king has imprisoned himself personally. So he's gone from the slave of the chief of the bodyguards to now he's rubbing elbows with other guys that Pharaoh has put into prison himself personally. He's gotten even closer to Pharaoh, right? Through the prison system. And we've noted it throughout this whole story of Joseph, the principle of divine providence just over and over again. Here's another one right here. The Lord moves him from here over to here. And there's Pharaoh right there. So now he's real close to Pharaoh. Through this incident with Mrs. P. I always wondered, when Joseph gets promoted to second in command in Pharaoh, what he said to her. Wonder what kind of a conversation they had at that point in time. We can only speculate. But at any rate, this is how the Lord has moved him right up to the point where he needs to be to get Pharaoh's attention, is through Potiphar's wife. If he had succumbed to her seduction, first of all, he'd be dead. But if he wasn't dead, he would still be a little further removed from Pharaoh than he is now. So ever closer in the Lord's plan for him. The Lord was with him in verse 21 and extended kindness to him and gave him favor in the sight of the chief jailer. So he was favored by Potiphar. He's now favored by the chief jailer. Everywhere this young man goes, God's blessing is upon him, even though it's all in a prison system right now. Won't be that way forever, but it is now. Everywhere he goes, God is with him, and God blesses his life. And the chief jailer committed to Joseph's charge all of the prisoners who were in the jail. So whatever was done there, he was responsible for it. Joseph is now, in essence, sort of the chief jailer. One removed, maybe. He's in charge of all these other people. And the chief jailer did not supervise anything under Joseph's charge because the Lord was with him. And whatever he did, the Lord made to prosper. Again, I'm reminded of Daniel and how the Lord blessed him there in Babylon and doing the same thing here with Joseph. So, what he doesn't know yet, he doesn't know the end of this story yet. He's going to find it out as he goes along in his life. We know it because we can read ahead. But what's going on here, of course, is the setting of the stage for the movement of this nation, this infant nation, Israel, from the land of the Canaanites down here to Egypt. And Joseph is the vehicle God's going to use. Why is he doing that? Look what happened to Judah. He hooks up with a Canaanite, has sons that are so wicked that God has to slay them. That's no place for this infant nation to grow into anything else. They could be destroyed and consumed by the Canaanites before they ever become a nation. God told them to leave them alone, but they know they're going to mess around with them anyway. So what he's going to do is to move them out of Canaan down here to Egypt, where they're protected by the Egyptian nation and can live as a group themselves, isolated from the Egyptians, and grow into a nation of 2 million people 430 years later. That's what he's doing. Joseph doesn't know all that yet, but he's using Joseph to do just that. He's now got him in a position to where he can hear some things, learn some things, and all of a sudden he's got Pharaoh's ear and he becomes second in charge in Egypt. He then gets the family down there, which we'll see, and they live down there and grow into a nation that can take the land for themselves under Joshua is when they do this, of course. So all of this is working toward the end game of building up the seed of the Abrahamic covenant in the form of the nation of Israel, which will take place down there in Egypt. See how the puzzles come together? As I say, Joseph doesn't know all this yet. All he knows is he's in prison. But we know it. We can see how God is working to bring all of this about and to get the seed portion of the Abrahamic covenant established, and it will be done down in Egypt. All right, any questions about anything we've seen here this morning in these two storylines? Judah becomes the main player of the sons in regards to the southern kingdom. Remember the southern two nations, Judah and Benjamin? They became the southern two tribes. Joseph follows the Ephraim's son, it becomes the leader of the northern 10 nations. So under the divided kingdom, Judah and Joseph become the progenitors of the leadership of those nations, the 10 nations in the north and the two nations in the south. So Judah and Joseph are now the primary players in our narrative, because they will be the primary ancestors of the nation Israel as we go forward. The morality of Judah is not nearly as impressive as the morality of Joseph. I am impressed with Joseph. This is an impressive young guy. Now, he looked like kind of a spoiled brat earlier, but things are changing for this guy. And I don't see how we can be anything other than favorably impressed by his behavior. He sought to please the Lord above all else, like Daniel did, and God was with him and God blessed him. Judah, on the other hand, he didn't give a flip. He just moved to wherever he wanted to go, hooked up with whoever he wanted to, and it's an altogether different situation. Nevertheless, the Lord did descend from the tribe of Judah. He is the progenitor of that. So any questions or comments about any of these, any things we've seen here in these two chapters? Yes, Kathy.
Do you think the coat that he left with the Potiphar's wife, same one with many colors?
No. Her question is, was the garment he had on at Potiphar's wife, was the coat of many colors? No. Remember, they soaked that thing in blood and it had been torn and messed up, so it was just whatever he happened to be wearing.
Wasn't it goat's blood?
Beg your pardon?
Wasn't it goat's blood?
Yeah. The goats are all over the place in this storyline.
This is sort of pre-Hollywood.
Yeah, that's right. Now, just whatever you happen to have on, I think, at that time. Any other questions or comments? Five women in our Lord's ancestry, four of whom have questionable marriages and ancestry. Tamar, the Canaanite here, twice widowed and involved with a relationship with her father-in-law. Who's another one of the...
Ruth.
Yeah, Ruth. Give me one before Ruth, if you can think of it.
Rahab.
Rahab the harlot. Ruth the Moabitess, her whole ancestry came from incestuous relationship between Lot and his daughters. And another one taking a bath.
Bathsheba.
Of course, Mary's the fifth one. But those ladies, Tamar, Rahab, Ruth, and Bathsheba, all have what you'd call questionable heritages. Ruth not so much, but the others. And yet, from them came our Lord, the Savior of mankind. The Lord can do whatever He wants to do, and does.